8 hours labour, 8 hours recreation, 8 hours rest was the rallying cry of Robert Owen, mill owner turned labour reformer in the early 19th century. For those toiling in factories for endless hours, Owen's slogan was a socialist dream that only became commonplace in the early 20th century. Spool forward to 2025, and the 9-to-5 is still standard. Yet, technology has moved on. We have artificial intelligence, automation, intuitive software at our fingertips. Shouldn't we be more productive while spending fewer hours at work? To give us an insight into alternative models of working is Professor Brendan Burchell, professor at the Faculty of Human, Social and Political Science at the University of Cambridge and fellow of Magdalen College. And he's been focusing on the effects of a 4-day working week for employers and employees. And also here is Professor Claire Kelleher from the Cranfield School of Management, who's been spearheading research into flexible working. Welcome, Claire. Welcome, Brendan. When you were invited to join the WE Society, what was your first thought? Claire, you go first.
Well, I was very pleased to be invited in the first instance, but I reflected a bit on the notion of WE Society and thought about it, particularly its appropriateness in the context of employment in the current environment that we're finding ourselves in. I think, you know, in order to remedy some of the issues that we face relating to employment, we need to think about employers and employees effectively working together to achieve their own particular sets of goals. So I don't mean it at the level of kind of, you know, just being said because it sounds nice, but I think this WE aspect is really important in relation to how we move forward with employment issues in the immediate future.
Brendan.
And these podcasts, they do take on some of the old ideas that we're still living by and thinking through how our society could be so much better if we embraced new ways of thinking. So, yeah, when I got the invite, I was really chuffed.
It's a very interesting career because for decades, really, you were kind of complaining about the labour market, stress, intensification at work, kind of alienation. And now you've discovered the 4-day working week and you're full of surrounded by happy, smiling people.
It really has been a transformation, and it's, yeah, the way it's come about, it's certainly made my life a lot more upbeat, talking to these. People love having a 3-day weekend. So going from, as you say, I spent probably the first 3 decades of my research life at Cambridge looking at all the ways in which labour markets made people miserable. And that's unfortunate because we know for most people their job is a positive thing in their life. But, of course, you can have too much of a good thing. And I think working 5 days a week is too much of a good thing. And so people are just so much happier and more productive when they work in a 4-day week. And we've got a lot of evidence in the last few years to show exactly how that works. And it works in the vast majority of organisations we go into.
Now, you talk about the vast majority of organisations you go into, but, I mean, still the standard, it's a 5-day week, 9-to-5, isn't it?
It is. And again, like lots of the things you discuss, it's a brave decision to go. And it's a counterintuitive one. Often with these societal problems, the obvious answer, like if you've got low productivity, get people working for longer hours, is exactly not the right way forward. And so in lots of those organisations, they're now more profitable or they're doing a better job, however they measure, you know, what performance is for them, and actually now performing better with people working a shorter working week.
Give us a sense of the scale of this. I mean, how many organisations, we have a workforce, I mean, give or take, of 30 million people, and 5 million, 5.5 million working in the public sector. I mean, what is it, a public sector phenomenon, a private sector phenomenon? How many, what proportion of that workforce is working a 4-day week, do you think?
This movement really started. The big drive we've had going forward, it works in different ways in different countries. Clearly, in France, they had that big drive for the 35-hour week, 20 years ago. What's happened in the UK, but also in the United States, Canada, Ireland, many other countries about the same time, is recruiting large numbers of organisations, hundreds of organisations, to reduce their working time by 20%. And that's the important thing. We're not talking about 4 days, 4 long days. We're talking about genuine working time reduction. And those organisations have thousands in our trials. There are a lot more out there that have also copied and haven't been in our trials. So, and we don't have an accurate number there.
Come on, have a stab.
I'm talking to, and the important thing here, it's not, we're not talking about individuals like myself who've decided to reduce their own working time. We're talking about whole organisations where everybody's working time is reduced. Certainly we're talking about hundreds of thousands in the UK now. Huh. But the exciting thing that's happened is a very big employer, South Cambridgeshire District Council, decided they were going to do a four-day week. They were almost forced into it. They were really finding it very difficult to provide the service. They were carrying on from austerity. They didn't have any more funding. They couldn't recruit to... They couldn't get lorry drivers. Lorry drivers were being offered 50% pay rises if they go long haul instead of on the bin rounds. The planners would get a lot more in the private sector. So they couldn't recruit. They were paying out hundreds of thousands of pounds each year in agency fees and golden hellos. So they decided it was what they called a wicked problem. It needed a new idea to solve it. They went to a four-day week, and I've been looking at their performance in detail. Not only did they recruit and fill all those vacancies, they didn't have to pay golden hellos anymore. They saved hundreds of thousands of pounds, and where any of their key performance indicators changed, they actually improved.
Now, Claire, you've been listening to this. What was your reaction to what Brenna was saying?
Well, I think it's a really good example of how when employers challenge their thinking, or they are challenged in the case of taking part in an experiment, to just think about work differently and the organisation of work in a different way. I think this is really powerful. You mentioned typically most organisations are still working 5 days and within designated working hours. Now, it's very easy to default of saying that that's the normal and therefore the best way of working, whereas I think there's a lot of evidence, not just this experiment, but this experiment is a really powerful one, lots of evidence to show that working in different ways brings benefit both for individuals but also for employing organisations.
Now, your proclamation is flexibility at work, which is, within whether it's 40 hours over 4 days or 5 days, your view is... Well, I'll let you express your view. Go on.
Yeah, I think that flexible working has been taking place in organisations over a long period of time.
By when you say flexible working...
Yes.
Leaving early, choosing your time. Exactly how do you what's the definition of flexible working?
Well, I would talk about it as where employees have some degree of choice over where they work, when they work, and the amount of hours that they work. And I'm thinking of that particularly when people are working part-time, although the four-day working week is also an example of people working less without being seen traditionally as part-time working. So really, those are the three key elements. Some people include other aspects of, say, for example, people taking sabbaticals from work, but all of the research work that I've done has been about sort of time, place and amount, if you like. And it's the key thing here is people being able to exercise some degree of choice over those aspects of their work.
When I was at university doing economics and sociology and, all the talk was of, work being alienating, work being definitionally exploitative, work being oppressive. Go back to the 1960s, 1970s, that was meant to be an endemic feature of modern capitalism. But you're both actually saying something rather different. You're both saying actually, a world of private capital is congruent with enfranchising workers more by giving them flexibility and choice over when and how they work. What's happened to enable this? What are the forces that are driving this change?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things happening there, as in giving people choice is an important aspect. There's decades of evidence about the importance of discretion at work in terms of...
workplace discretion, autonomy.
Yes, giving positive outcomes for individuals and that impacting on how they work, which in essence, flexible working is very closely related to this idea of discretion. But I think, this moving away from traditional models has in part been because the nature of the work that organisations need doing has also changed. So a traditional model of when people turn up to work and where they turn up to work doesn't necessarily fit the nature of work itself, as work has changed, with technology, with globalisation, with different competitive pressures, when perhaps organisations feel the need to be more agile, for example. And so as a result, flexibility is in some senses a way of fitting those things together. But there are also labour market pressures as well. Work we did more than a decade ago now was very much driven by employers who wanted to be able to recruit high-calibre graduates and wanted to put out a proposition, a competitive proposition, and work being able to maintain a better work-life balance was something that all of their research that they had done had found that this is what graduates were looking for. They weren't looking for, you know, the traditional jobs where they'd be working at least 5 days a week and very long hours. That had changed in terms of what people were looking for out of work as well. And since then, there have been ripples of that on a much wider scale, I think.
I mean, both of you are kind of, you know, it's good news, you know. The four-day week is working. It's spreading hundreds of thousands, soon to be millions. And you're saying flexibility of working. On the other hand, there's, you know, I mean, listeners to this podcast, they'll be thinking, well, hold on a minute. You know, there's the gig economy. There's, I mean, people, you know, zero hour contracts. I mean, there's Will Hutton there kind of saying that maybe modern capitalism is less exploitative than it was maybe 50 years ago. What the hell is he talking about? Because, you know, there's a hell of a lot of exploitation at the bottom of the labour market. And I'm trying to kind of get this different strands of this kind of out there, because there's bad news in the labour market as well as all this good news.
There is. And as you say, labour markets, well, they're complicated things. And there is that exploitation side of it. And there are bad jobs out there. Fortunately, I think they're a minority of jobs in the UK at the moment. Jobs where people are being underpaid, being bullied at work, being in very bad physical conditions, facing insecurity. The places where we're first seeing a four-day week and the good sides of flexibility come out at the moment seem to be employer-led often. And again, if we look back 100 years, when we went from that transition from a six-day week to a five-day week, it happened in different ways in different countries. But primarily in the United States, it was because the Ford factory decided they could make and sell more cars by working efficiently over 5 days than exploiting workers to work 6 days. In other countries, it was trade union pressure or government regulation. And I think we need to think about all three of those things as we move towards a better labour market. And at the moment, we're seeing far-sighted employers adopting these and getting an advantage in the labour market because they can attract the best employees and get the best out of them with flexibility and with a shorter working week. But I think we're going to have to look at regulation at some point to bring in the gig economy, the zero-hour contracts.
Because, Claire, I mean, is there a new form of stratification taking place? The kind of, you know, middle-class folk, educated, college-educated, have all these opportunities of flexible working, four-day weeks. But actually, you know, there's an underclass, a working class, maybe you want to call it that, for whom the old conditions still prevail and there's no chance of it changing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important when we're discussing these issues to distinguish between the types of flexibility that are driven by employers in their interests and those that are offered to employees in order to improve work-life balance and maybe some of the associated benefits from this. Now, I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. I think you can find both those features sometimes in the same job. So say, for example, if you look at somebody on zero-hours contracts, but perhaps in the gig economy, may have some choice over when they work. Now, one has to obviously look at that in the context of the security or lack of security that they have in their work. But the point I'm really making is that I don't think these are necessarily two things which don't sometimes coexist in the same job. You're right, the point that perhaps flexible working traditionally has been a privilege of the professional middle classes. There certainly has been, you know, much debate among scholars about really saying, is this really something that is for a minority of workers? But even before the pandemic, which I think acted as a significant catalyst for increase in flexible working, you know, we'd seen steady growth in terms of the types of flexible working being exercised by individuals and the combinations of them as well. So it's has permeated, I think, a much wider range of jobs. And with the forthcoming legislation that's proposed by the new government, that will provide some additional opportunities. I think one has to recognise the limitations of legislation here, but that it will bring things onto the agenda in the way in which the original legislation did in the early 2000s, to make it an issue, to make it something that organisations developed policies about that people became much more aware of. So I think we have seen quite a lot of progress in it being more diverse of who has access to flexible working. There are probably some groups of employees who still have much a stronger bargaining power in terms of the particular arrangement that they like. But generally speaking, I think we're seeing it moving in the right direction.
You make thousands of decisions every day. Most are inconsequential, but the big ones shape your future. There's a podcast that can help you make better decisions. It's called The Art of Deciding, with award-winning financial journalist Bruce Whitfield. Bruce asks high achievers how they make their biggest decisions, including Jack Reacher creator Lee Child, on how he took control of his future after being fired, poker champion Liv Borry on why trusting your gut is not a strategy, plus the former chairman of the Court of the Bank of England, Sir Brad Freed, who delivers a masterclass in managing strong teams. The Art of Deciding with Bruce Whitfield is available wherever you get your podcasts. There's so many things happening simultaneously. I mean, there's the rise of stress at work, and the rise of mental illness, sometimes following on from stress at work. So there's that narrative. Then there's those who defend the zero-hour contracts often argue that actually a proportion of people kind of hanker for it in the name of flexibility, but the vast majority don't. These cross currents. There's the negative stuff's going on. Productivity is flat, and here you are, beacons of hope in the studio. Can you kind of back that up with kind of some sense of this being a growing movement and numbers?
Certainly, I think the numbers of people going to that four-day week in the UK aren't enough yet to have a significant effect on the macroeconomic figures. And it is one of those things you'd only believe when you actually see figures. It does sound incredible. When I first heard these claims that were being made, that people could be as productive or more productive in 32 hours rather than 40 hours, I didn't believe them, or if I did think that was going to happen, I thought it would be at some other negative costs. They were going to have to be working so intensively under such time pressure, it would more than offset the benefits. You need to look in detail at these things, and clearly there are teething problems when you introduce new ways of working. You need to think about how you schedule differently. Managers need to be smart at what they do in order to get the best out of these things. And when these new systems fail, it's often because the managers haven't been good enough at their jobs in order to introduce them well enough. But certainly the evidence, like I say, we can see really detailed from South Cambridgeshire District Council. We know how quickly they manage planning applications, how quickly they pick up the phone, how quickly they'll fix your house if you've got a hole in the roof. And those things, there's massive, clear evidence of a very significant improvement. I wasn't involved in that initial decision for them to go to the four-day week, but then I was brought in as an independent assessor to look at the performance indicators once they'd gone down that route, because obviously it became so politically contentious. Our previous Conservative government did so much to try and stop them working in this new productive way that they needed to bring in objective outsiders.
Well, famously, Jacob Rees-Mogg walking the floor would leave notes on people's empty desks saying, why aren't you back?
I can fully understand somebody being sceptical about these new ideas, but what does annoy me as a social scientist is when you provide clear evidence that a new way of working is better, and yet people are still stuck in such an old way. We still have got a hangover of old work ethics, the idea that you have to show your loyalty by being first to arrive in the office and last to leave. And some of those things, they take a while to change. Oh, they are changing. Again, in lots of those new organisations we're looking at, everyone thinks if you're really good at your job, you can do it in 4 days. And the people who are having to spend more time at work is because they're not working efficiently. There are new ways of working.
One of the things that I wondered whether or not you looked at in this study was about energy. Some work we did some while ago on part-time workers found that people who work part-time, even though they might have had very busy non-work lives, actually brought more energy to work when they were at work.
How do you measure energy? How do you measure it?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, some of the engagement surveys attempt to look at energy for work, but I'm just wondering whether or not it was something that was built into this one at all.
Absolutely. And we know that we've spent, me and my team, as a large team of people working with me on this, we spend a lot of time talking one-on-one with people. And that's exactly as you described, that they've had often their old weekends were largely taken up, particularly if they're kids, with just getting everybody ready to go back to school, homework done, clothes washed. Now they have so much more leisure time. Yes, and they arrive with energy at work. And we pick it up. We also, now we have thousands, literally thousands of cases across the world where we measure at the beginning of the trials, and we typically run them for 6 months in the first instance, and then during trial, at the end of the trial, their energy levels, their burnout levels, their engagement with work. And we find really significant improvements pretty much across the board in all those measures. So absolutely, as you describe it, people really feel that when they're at work, they can devote a lot more energy to that work if they're there for 4 days. I call it a four-day week, and it's a nice catchphrase, but we can implement it flexibly for some organisations. They're working 5 short days. In some organisations, they do it over the year, that they're working much shorter weeks off season. So as long as they've got a genuine working time reduction, that's what I'm interested in.
And what are folk doing with their days off? I mean, are they...
Oh, I just get great stories. People, they're just taking their dogs for longer walks. They're spending more time with their kids. They're watching Netflix, you know, whatever people want to do. They are doing a bit of work as well. It's interesting. They're still often doing a bit of catching up on the Friday. And often that's what they would have been doing on the Saturday. Things. And of course, it takes a while for people to settle into this new pattern and for them to realise in most cases it's going to become permanent, because we follow up these companies now over 2 years, and in the vast majority of cases, it's become a permanent thing.
It's quite a new thing, this, isn't it? I mean, as we're talking about, you know, really since 2020, I mean, the trigger moment seems to have been COVID, the epidemic.
When I was doing this research on radical reductions in working time before the pandemic, even my colleagues told me I was a bit utopian, fantasy thinking. Why wasn't I concentrating on real world problems? The pandemic changed that. Now it's been taken seriously, not just by employers, but wider society. I think a big difference between Claire's approach and my approach, the 4 day week approach, is, and they're totally compatible with it. Like I say, they're not opposite, so they're achieving the same thing. For the 4 day week, it's everybody gets the same deal. Everybody gets that working time reduction in the whole organisation, or in some countries, we're thinking about happening in the whole country. But when it's applied to everybody in an organisation, then men and women get that equally, whether they want it or not. But people do want it. You know, 97% of our sample say they absolutely love working on a 4 day week and don't want to go back. When you introduce flexibility, particularly when it's reduced hours, part-time work, then you tend to get gender differences opening up. For all sorts of reasons in our society, it tends to be the women that take those part-time jobs or want the working time reduction, and they go with a pay reduction. That opens up the gender pay gap. Then you get those women in part-time jobs are much less likely to get promoted, which means they're not going to get the same sort of top jobs. They're not going to get the same pensions. So I think that choice, and it is the good thing about flexible working that Claire's talking about, is also has got that negative side to it. So that's why, for me, I think our long-term goal in terms of reducing the working week for everybody is something I'd prioritise over thinking of how we can suit individual jobs to individual people.
Nodding there, Claire.
I think that there are certainly issues around gender divide or even other groups in the labour market that, you know, there's been some element historically of a stigma associated with flexible working. Some employers thinking, you know, if people want to work flexibly, maybe they're a bit less serious about their career, you know, less committed to the organisation because they've got these other things going on in their lives. And I think that there has been a penalty associated with that. I think to some degree, the experimentation that has been taking place in recent years has moved us forward in that direction, and there are perhaps less. But I take the point that when it is open to everyone, the notion of sort of a collective is an important one here. But I also think there's a key factor in relation to choice. And for much of my work, looking at outcomes associated with different forms of flexible working, we have seen the primary influence on those positive outcomes have been about employees being able to exercise choice. Now, in the case of the 4-day working week, that may work for many, as in they would have chosen it if they had been able to choose it. There may be others that isn't necessarily their actual preference, but you did say there are some variations in the approaches that have been used. And so I guess it's maybe about finding what works best for the type of work that's being done and the nature of the workforce that you have.
And of course, within the 4-day week, once you've given that working time reduction, how people do that, whether they do it over 4 days or over 5 shorter days, whether there's that annualized aspect to it, and to what extent they're working from home, all those things again are open. And some of the new experiments that are now underway at the moment in the UK are looking at that fusion of the 4-day week and flexible working. And there's no reason, I can't see any reason why those two can't, as we're saying, go hand in hand.
I mean, in the introduction, I mentioned Robert Owen and, you know, and the battle cries over the 19th century over going from a 12-hour day to a 10-hour day to an 8-hour day, and the role of organised labour and trade unions in actually pushing for this. But this seems to be happening, in the private sector. I mean, the union density is not much more than 10%, only 1 in 10 people working in the private sector, members of unions. And yet, this is not happening because of union pressure. This is happening because of, firms enlightenedly saying, let's do it, HR departments advocating it. But where's it coming from?
You're right. Trade unions in the UK at the moment are behind the curve on this. And often when I'm talking to trade unions, it's because I ask to talk to them. They're not coming to me saying, this is what our members want. It's happening now. Unison have gone down this route and have advocated for the 4-day week. I think trade unions in the UK have been very narrow, often, in their interests around pay. And looking at the wider quality of the working life for employees, they haven't been taken a big enough picture. But in other countries, again, that's different. In other countries, we have seen the big, say, particularly German trade unions pushing for working time reduction for quite a long time now, but doing it a different way, doing it in a very gradual way, always looking to shave the 15 minutes here and 30 minutes there off the working week over a longer period of time, rather than these radical reductions, 20% reductions that we've seen more recently in the trials that we've been running in the last couple of years.
I'm just going to draw this to a close. I mean, it's been a great conversation. I mean, seeing social scientists with smiles on their faces like this and talking so optimistically is kind of really a kind of tonic. But I just, literally a sentence. Brennan, you go first to give the last word to Claire. 25 years' time, what's it going to look like? Are we going to have what's the world of work going to look like? You've got one sentence.
I think the change to the 4-day week being the norm is going to come much more like 5 to 10 years.
Claire?
Yeah, I think we will see much greater variety in the way in which people work being normalised as just the normal way of working. And again, I would say, and I'm hopeful, that we will see that much sooner than 25 years.
Well, Brendan Birchall and Claire Keller, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation. And I've done a lot of these podcasts over the last 2 or 3 years, and this is one of the sunnier ones, actually. Kind of social scientists with a spring in their step. So thank you both very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, who can be found at acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. Thank you so much for listening.